Well, good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Hey, thank you for braving the snow and the ice, right? If you can get here from Berkeley, all right, you can get here. There's no excuses, right, Renoso? That's right. So, if we haven't met, my name's Mike. I'm one of the pastors on staff here. It's good to have you here with us. As Jody was saying, we are in week two of our series, Rethink Money. Which whenever we do a series on money and we have new people come to church, I get a little bit nervous. And it's not that I don't like new people at church. I'm always excited when somebody is new at church, but somebody walks in for the first time and you're talking about money at church and people go, wait, what's going on? What do they want from me here? And if somebody's here for the first time this week, they didn't have the benefit of being here last week where we kind of explained, hey, this is why we are doing this and why this makes sense. And this is why this series is all about not what we want from you, but what we want for you instead. And so what we're doing in this series is we're just coming at the idea of money, and we're trying to rethink how we do money because the way that our culture encourages us to think about money isn't working. And in this series, we're just trying to put practical, simple, applicable tools in our hands that help us rethink how about money and to help us to do money differently, to do it in a way that actually works. Because again, the way that we tend to get presented by our culture when it comes to money is pretty one-sided. Now, to try and help us illustrate some of this, we've got a picture for you here. And as this picture comes up, what I want you to do, don't share your answer. Don't cheat with your neighbor. All right, you just want to look at a picture and in your head, not out loud, decide, what is this a picture of? Everybody got an answer? All right, ooh, look at you, you're all responsive this morning. I like this, all right. You're still all hyped up on adrenaline because, you know, you almost died out on the roads. Now some of us, when we looked at this picture, we saw the black vase. We saw the black vase that's ready to receive some flowers, and that's all we saw. Others of us, we looked at this picture, and we saw the two white faces looking into one another's eyes, and that's all that we saw. Some of us, all we saw was a vase. Some of us, all we saw were their faces. Now, just out of curiosity, who are my vase people? All right, who are my face people? Who just saw two people getting ready to kiss? Sex fiends, right? All right, so here's the thing, though. when it comes to money, our culture is like, hey, there's one way to see this. There's one way to think about this. There's just one way to do this. And in this series, we're saying, no, there is another way to see this. There is another way to think about this. There is another way to do this. And there's a way that works better. And so that's what we're trying to do in this series. So let's just take a minute and pray, invite God to be part of this, pray for some of the concerns in our church and in our world, and then we'll dive into today's topic. Father, just again, thanks that we're here and that we got here safely. God, there's just so much going on right now, just locally, globally, right here in our church family. Father, we just want to pray for Puerto Rico and for the people there. Just some of the people sitting in this room, do they have friends and family and loved ones there? God, please work in the midst of that disaster. Please bring the earthquakes to an end. Please help the recovery and the relief efforts. God, thank you for ministries like Covenant World Relief that we get to partner with. And while we can't necessarily just jump in a car and drive to Puerto Rico and be there to help, we can partner with Covenant World Relief as they get boots on the ground to try and make a difference there and try bring relief to this disaster, to a place that is still trying to recover from the last one. Father, just we want to pray for some of the folks right here in our midst, just for Melbourne and his family, as his father Horatio was mourning the loss of his wife. God, I pray you would meet that family, that you would help Melbourne, that you would help his dad, that you would comfort them, that you would bring peace and healing. Father, we want to pray for our brother Bill and for our sister Jennifer, as both of them this week are getting ready to have surgery. Pray that you would guide the doctors and their hands, that you give them wisdom, and we pray for quick and speedy recoveries for them. God, just as we talk about money in church today, please just break through some of the resistance that we naturally have. Please just open our minds to you and to your truth. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. So as we talk about money today, we're going to start off, we said last week, each week we're going to take a different topic as it relates to money. So today we're going to talk about debt. And as we talk about debt today, it can be helpful to think about the national debt here in the United States, because how we tend to deal with debt as a country mirrors how we tend to deal with debt as individual families. Now, to talk about debt as we deal with it as a country, you need to look back a little bit historically, and so we're going to do some of that right now. Who can tell me who was the president throughout most of the 80s? Oh, very good. It's before my time, but I appreciate you helping me out. So Reagan was president through most of the 80s, all right? Now, during Reagan's tenure, the national debt in the United States went from $1 trillion to $2.6 trillion. 160% increase. And if you remember the 80s, like, people freaked out. They were losing their minds over how much the national debt increased under Reagan, a supposed financial conservative, right? Now, what people shouldn't have been saying is, oh! What they should have been saying is, you ain't seen nothing yet, all right? Oh, for the days of Reagan, all right? And I say that because under President Clinton's watch, the national debt went from $4.2 trillion to $5.7 trillion. And then under George W., the national debt went from 5.7 to 10.6. Had to pay for that war in Iraq somehow, right? Then under President Obama, the national debt went from 10.6 to $19.9 trillion. Biggest monetary increase in the national debt in our country's history. And today, under President Trump, the national debt, when I checked last getting ready for this message, it's just over $23 trillion. Oh, for the days of Reagan. Now, here's the real fun about all this. The 2019, the federal government's budget was $4.4 trillion. That means you could throw the entire year's budget at the national debt, you could do so more than five times over and still not pay it off. This is a problem. We can't keep living like this as a country. If you don't believe me, ask the citizens of Greece. They will tell you, all right? But we just keep plowing on ahead with this. In fact, most of us, when we walked in this room today, we probably weren't thinking about this. We probably weren't worried about this. All kinds of us in this room today didn't even know this. This is how we deal with debt as a nation. And this is how we tend to deal with debt as individuals. Average American has 3 to 4 credit cards. Average American household carries about $16,000 in credit card debt. About 37% of us, if we have a bill that's unexpected come across our desk that's $1,000 or more, we can't pay it without borrowing money. Think about this. We've got $16,000 in credit card debt and less than $1,000 in the bank. See, we can't keep doing this. And we can probably get away with this for less time as a family than we can as a nation, because as a family, you can't print your own money. They won't let you do that, right? But here's the thing. While we have a limited amount of influence over this on a national level, we have control over this on our family's level. See, you and I, there may be little to nothing we can do to stop an economic crash on a national level, but our decisions determine whether or not one happens on a family level. So today we're going to spend some time, we're going to talk about debt. Now, to help us do this, we're going to turn to a widow and some wisdom. Look at your neighbor and tell them, a widow and some wisdom. Yeah. The widow's story, it's found in the Old Testament. And We're going to look at her story and see what it'll teach us about how debt works. And then we're going to turn to some wisdom and see what wisdom would tell us about how to get out of debt and how to stay out of debt. Now, the widow that I have in mind, her story is recorded for us in the book of 2 Kings, and it picks up right at the beginning in chapter 4. And her story starts like this. The wife of a man from the company of the prophets cried out to Elisha, "Your servant, my husband, is dead. And you know that he revered the Lord, but now his creditor is coming to take my boys as his slaves." So as this story begins here, you have a prophet. Can anybody tell me the prophet's name? No, that's the other prophet. Can anybody tell me the widow's husband, the prophet, his name? You can't tell me his name because we don't know his name, all right? All right. But it's easier to talk about somebody if they have a name to go with. So we're going to give him the name Fred, all right? Fred the prophet. Just go with it, Menko, all right? So Fred the prophet. So Fred the prophet, he's married. Fred the prophet, he's a good man, right? He's among the company of the prophets. We don't have time to unpack all that means. But suffice it to say, Fred the prophet is in ministry. He reveres the Lord. He is living his life for God. He's a good man. But being a good man, his spiritual status, that does not somehow exempt Fred from the realities of the world that we live in. That's not how life works. And so Fred he's subject to just the physical realities of the world we live in. Fred gets sick. We don't know what he got sick with, but we know it's bad enough. Fred gets sick and he dies. And Fred he's subject to the financial realities of the world that we live in. Somehow Fred gets into debt. And Fred, he tries to borrow his way out of that problem. And so when Fred dies, it leaves his wife with a couple of issues. She has to mourn the loss of her spouse, and now she gets to deal with his financial problems on top of that. Now, we don't know necessarily how Fred got into debt. Maybe the economy was bad. Maybe there was a hostile, political climate towards prophets at that time. It was hard to get a decent job. Maybe Fred had an emergency. See, we're not sure how Fred got into debt, but how this happens to us, it's really not that complicated. Let me tell you a story and see if it sounds familiar to you, all right? You're a young couple, just got married, you got love, but you don't got much money, right? Remember that when you were a young couple? Right? And so you don't have a whole lot of money, and so one night you're just sitting down on the couch, just dreaming that maybe somebody would send you some free money in the mail. But money doesn't work like that. And that's just silly. Nobody sends you free money in the mail. So you take what little money you have and you go down to the bank and you open an account so you have a legitimate financial institution through which to pay your bills. And you do this all the while not realizing that banks spend more money than just about anybody else on marketing their products. And so shortly after you open your account, lo and behold, an offer comes in the mail for a credit card. Maybe free money does come in the mail. And you start to read through the offer on this little baby, and you're like, wait a minute. They are going to charge me 18% interest or more to borrow money on their card. Only a moron would borrow money at 18%. I would never do that. But they so thoughtfully sent me this little baby. And so I'm just going to hang on to this. I'm going to hang on to this just in case I have an... This happened to you too, right? All right, so you hold on to this, right? And so one night, you and your spouse, you're doing the bills, and you're having the classic, money's tight, so you're having the bill fight, and the kids are hiding under the furniture because of all the tension, right? And you finally manage at the end of the night to get all the bills paid. And there's $1.27 left in your checking account. But the bills are paid. We might only get to eat every other day, but hey, the bills are paid, right? And then you go to bed that night, proud of yourselves that you got the bill paid. And the next morning you get up and you get into your car and you turn the key and nothing happens. Doesn't matter what you do, that thing won't start. And so you get your car to the mechanic, and the mechanic tells you, hey, your starter's fried. That's why your car won't start. You need a new starter. And you explain to the mechanic, I have $1.27 in my account. And the mechanic says, we don't sell starters for $1.27. And so you think, just this once, I'm going to put it on the card, because this is an... Right. Who knew? Cars broke down. Like, that's never happened before, right? But you got to go to work. So this is an emergency. So just this once, you put it on the card. And you get your car fixed, and away you go. And then August rolls around. And the kids come into the house, and they kind of like this when they come walking in, right? And your kids tell you, Mom, Dad, we got issues. I need school clothes. Look, either you're going to buy me clothes or you're going to pay for the counseling. It doesn't matter. It's going to cost you money one way or the other, right? And you tell those kids, who told you to grow? I did not give you permission to grow. I told you to wait till Christmas to grow. Then your grandparents would have bought you the clothes. Who told you to grow, right? But you got to do so. Your kids got to have clothes. And you never do this, but just this once, you're going to put it on here because it's an emergency, right? And then November rolls around. And you're eating your Thanksgiving turkey. And about halfway through the meal, you choke. Because you realize this year, Christmas comes in December. Like, who saw that coming, right? Right? And you think, we got to get the kids gifts. If we don't get the kids a whole pile of gifts, they're going to be emotionally scarred for life, and I'll be a bad parent, and I didn't save any money for Christmas this year. So just this once, I'm going to put it on here, because this year, Christmas is an... Yeah. See, we go down to the bank, and we give them our money, and they give us 2%, 3% if we're lucky. And then they loan our money back to us at 18%. What a deal if you're the bank, right? Now, we don't know exactly how Fred got into trouble. For us, it's really not that complicated. More often than not, it involves one of these. Or maybe it involves the house we live in, or the car we drive, or the furniture we sit on, or whatever else. The story's really not that complicated. Fred, somehow, he gets into trouble. And when Fred does, Fred has some problems. Some big problems. You see, we don't know necessarily how Fred got into debt, but we know what Fred's debt did to him and his family. Because here's how debt works. Debt destroys and debt enslaves. Debt destroys and debt enslaves. See, in Fred's day, when somebody borrows money, they got to put something up as collateral. It's just how it works. And if you don't have anything, if you don't have any stuff to put up, then you put yourself up as collateral. Which means that when the creditor comes along to collect the bill, if you don't have the money to pay, you then go into indentured servitude. You work for up to 7 years for free for your creditor to pay that bill off. This is what Fred did. Only trouble is, Fred, he dies. And so now his debt passes on to his family. And now the creditor's coming to collect the bill, and his family can't pay, which means that his children are now going to go into slavery. His children are now going to work for his creditors for up to 7 years for free to pay off his debt. Think about that. Imagine your kid working some sweatshop job for up to 7 years to pay off your outstanding bills. And I know some of you are thinking, where do I sign up for that one, right? They can have them for free. I mean, you're going to pay off my debts with them? That'd be amazing. It doesn't work quite like that for Fred and his wife. See, Fred's wife lives in a day and age where if she's going to be provided for, it's not going to be through her work. She lives in a day and age where women did not have a legitimate means of making money. Provision came from your husband, and if something happened to your husband, provision came from your sons. If something happens to your sons, you're lucky if you can beg your way into a life of abject poverty. More likely, you're forced to turn to prostitution or to theft. Fred, his situation is no good for his wife and his kids. It's going to destroy and enslave his family. And unfortunately, Fred's story, this isn't something that's limited to just biblical times. Like, about a year ago, I watched Fred's story replay itself with Jack and Jill. Jack died at work, had a massive heart attack at his desk, dropped dead there. Now, Jill didn't know, but Jack had been financing large portions of their life on credit cards and with debt. And so when he died, not only does Jill have to deal with Jack's death, but now all of his debts passed down to her. And she's trying to figure out, what am I going to do with these things? I watched her have to sell the house. I watched her have to sell the vehicles. I watched her sell everything in the house that wasn't nailed down up on eBay. I watched this woman who'd been a stay-at-home mom for years have to go back to work. Her entire life, her entire standard of living, everything was turned upside down. Just sidebar, gentlemen, that story is not okay. Men, you have a responsibility to make sure if something happens to you, your family is going to be all right. Now, far from doing everything right in my marriage and my family, I don't even come close to that. If you want good dirt, talk to my wife, talk to my kids. They'll give it up on me, all right? This is one that I've gotten right. Because stories like Jack and Jill's, they kept me up at night. And so today, because of the insurance today, financially, I am worth more dead than I am alive today, all right? This is how it works, right? So if I got hit by a bus on the way home from church today, like financially, Laura would be okay. I mean, you'd see her at church next week. Oh, he was a good man, right? And then when the checks come in, you'll see her at church. Oh, he was a good man, right? When something happens to me, my biggest problem isn't the money from my wife. It's the jokers that are trying to get with my wife now that she's single, all right? I told her, honey, you can get remarried. You're going to be hearing noises in the bedroom, all right? I don't believe in reincarnation, but I'm straight up haunting that part of the house, all right? So you can get remarried, you just can't enjoy the sex. This is how this works, okay? So, but welcome to a little window into our world, right? So, seriously though, debt, it destroys. It just destroys. We talked about this a little bit last week. How the number one cause for divorce in North America is money fights. The Utah State University did a fascinating study on this. A couple of the results should grab our attention. They said couples who disagree about money one time a week are 2 times more likely to get divorced than couples who disagree about money less than once a month. Couples who have $10,000 in debt and no money in savings are twice as likely to get divorced as couples who have $10,000 in savings and no debt. See, bottom line, money breaks up more families in America than infidelity does. That's crazy. This stuff destroys families. Not only so, but this stuff enslaves. Like, if you've got a $7,500 balance on this thing, and you just make the minimum payments until you pay it off, you know what it'd take you 8 years to pay that off? And that by the time you pay the interest and you pay the principal, you'll have paid more than $15,000 to take care of that debt. That's bondage. Or student loans. This is just an epidemic today. And people don't realize the impact that these things have. I watch these students not just take loans so they can pay the tuition. They will take loans and then live off of those loans for 4 to 6 years, having no idea the kind of impact those things have on their lives. Now, we found a great video that kind of chronicles how student loans impact. Just to give us a sense of this, let's watch together.
Oh. I got mine when I was 18.
I got them when I was 21.
Student loans.
Student loans.
I contracted student loans at 19, and I'm one of millions.
Almost half of all Americans between the ages of 18 and 22 are fiscally active. Many do not understand the risk they are taking when they contract a student loan.
All of my friends were going to college. I just wanted to fit in. Now I have a degree in comparative philosophy, no job, and a full-blown case of student loans.
Studies show that those infected with student loan debt are less likely to date regularly or have bed frames. Even if not exposed to student loan debt directly, they can be transmitted by legal marriage.
I married the love of my life, except she didn't tell me about her student loan debt. Now it's our student loan debt.
It is possible to lead a healthy, active, fulfilling life with student loan debt. Just not for very long.
I used to love cereal. Then I contracted student loan debt, and now it's all I eat. I miss protein.
Student loans only get worse with time and can manifest in many ways. Studio apartments, having roommates well into your 30s, top ramen, and driving a car older than yourself. If you have been exposed to student loan debt, contact an accountant today. There is no cure for student loan debt, and there is no hope.
So have rich parents.
Have rich parents.
Have rich parents.
Or play the lotto.
Hey, you never know. Paid for by the New York State Lotto.
Right? So here's the thing, though. It enslaves. Like, when I'm in debt, I'm not free. I'm not free. I'm not free to rest. I'm not free to do what I want. I'm not free to do what I should. Just, if you've got debt right now, think about it. How much better would you sleep if you didn't have any debt hanging over your head? The money that you put towards the payments on those debts, like, how much fun could you have if that was your money to do whatever you wanted with? How much good could you do with the money you send towards the debts that you have? Debt destroys and debt enslaves. So the question then becomes, okay, well, then how do we get out of this? What do we do with this thing? So let's go back to our widow. Elisha replied to her, "How can I help you? Tell me what to do. What do you have in your house? Your servant has nothing at all. That's why I'm coming to you, man." She said, "Except a small jar of oil." Elisha said, "Go around and ask all your neighbors for empty jars. Don't ask for just a few. Then go inside, shut the door behind you and your sons. Pour oil into the jars. As each is filled up, put it aside." So she left him, she collects all the jars, she shut the door behind her and her sons. And they brought the jars to her, and she kept pouring. When all the jars were full, she said to her son, "Bring me another one." He replied, "There's not another jar left." Then the oil stopped flowing. She went and told the man of God and he said, "Go and sell the oil, pay your debts, and you and your sons can live off of what is left." Now, can we just be honest? That story is weird, all right? The woman comes, she's like, "I got no money, my husband's dead, they're coming to take my boys away, what do I do, Elisha?" And he's like, "You go to your neighbors and you collect as many empty jars as you can get your hands on." That's just bizarre. It's weird, all right? Here's the thing, though. This woman gets a message. A message that seems weird, a message that seems countercultural, a message that is counterintuitive. But because she did what was weird and countercultural and counterintuitive, it delivered her from debt. Listen, God has sent us a message about debt. And for some of us, for a lot of us, it's going to seem weird. Because we've looked at money and debt just one way for so long. To look at it God's way is going to seem weird. Weird and counterintuitive and countercultural. But if you want to get out, you need to do what the messenger is saying. And God has sent us wisdom through his message to help us get out. So let's look at some of what wisdom has to say. For starters, Wisdom would say to us, you want to get out of debt? Stop borrowing money. Here's how wisdom says it. It says, do not be one who shakes hands in a pledge or puts up security for debt. That's a fancy way of saying, hey, don't get into debt. Don't borrow money. If you lack the means to pay, your very bed will be snatched out from under you. In other words, I'm not going to find financial freedom by borrowing more money. I'm not going to get out of debt by creating more debt. If that's what I do, my bed will be snatched out from under me. That's Proverbs' way of saying repo or foreclosure. That's the biblical way of saying those things. He's saying, no, you want to get out of debt. You have to stop buying things you can't afford. You know how you know if you can afford something? You have the money to pay for it. If I go out and I buy something that I don't have the money to pay for, I can't afford that thing, and I have to go into debt to do it. And here's the thing. If I'm going to get out of debt, I have to stop borrowing more money. And chances are, for a lot of us, this is the way we got in there. And if this is the way we got in, the temptation to keep using this thing is almost overwhelming. If I'm going to stop borrowing, if I'm going to stop spending money I don't have, I need to do what Dave Ramsey calls a plastectomy. I need to cut these things up. I don't save the numbers so I can get online and enter them in manually on the computer. Right? I need to burn the numbers. I need to cut these things up. I got to stop spending money that I don't have. I got to quit borrowing the stuff. If I'm going to buy something, I'm going to buy it with money I already have, because if I have the money, I can afford it. If I don't have the money, I can't. And I'm not going to buy what I can't afford. So wisdom would say, hey, you want to get out of debt? It's not that complicated. Stop borrowing money. Second thing wisdom would say to us is this: save some money. Save some money. Wisdom says it this way. He says, the wise store up choice food and oil, but fools gulp theirs down. In other words, wise people, they save some money. They have a little bit of money in savings. Foolish people, they spend every dollar that comes their way. Now, here's why this is important. Because you and me, we're like Fred in more ways than we realize. One of the ways we're like Fred is, doesn't matter if we're following Jesus. Doesn't matter if we're good, godly people. We are not exempt from how life works. You can be following Jesus and the roof is going to leak. And the car is going to break down. And the plumbing is going to back up. And there'll be layoffs at work. We're not exempt from these kind of financial realities. And if we don't save up some money, when the emergency happens, if this has been our emergency fund and we've cut it up, if we don't save some money up, we're going to be looking for crazy glue trying to put this thing back together again. No, an emergency fund is where we actually have money that we don't, cash money that we don't touch, except when it's truly an emergency. You save up some money so that when emergency comes, when life happens, you can afford to pay for it. Now, best practice tells us that you start off with a $1,000 emergency fund, and then as you achieve financial stability, you work towards growing that to 3 to 6 months of operating expenses. Start off with a $1,000 emergency fund, and you grow that to 3 to 6 months of operating expenses. And I know what some of you are thinking. Some of us are thinking, there's no way. There is no way I'm going to be able to save $1,000. I am in debt up to my eyeballs. My budget doesn't balance now. I can't pay the bills that are coming in. Where am I going to get $1,000? You're out your mind. To which I would say this. Call to mind somebody in your life who you love. In fact, who in your life do you love the most? Call to mind the most important person in your life. Maybe it's your spouse. If you're married, it should be your spouse. That's another series. But maybe it's your spouse. All right? Just saying. Maybe it's your kid. Maybe it's your grandchild. Maybe it's a sibling. Just call them out. Who is the most important person in your life? Now, let's say tomorrow That person, they just become incredibly ill, bedridden, cannot move, kind of ill. You get them to the hospital and the doctor tells you they have a rare disease and they are going to die in 90 days because of that disease. Your wife, your husband, your son, your daughter, your grandchild, your sibling, they have 90 days to live. The good news is there's this brand new medication available. It will cure that disease. The only trouble is it costs $1,000. You cannot borrow money, and you cannot use money you already have, and you have to pay in cash. Now, if we've got 90 days to come up with $1,000 to save our spouse, our child, our grandchild, our sibling, how many of us are going to find a way to do that?
GoFundMe.
That's right. We're going to GoFundMe. We're going to get a second job. We're going to work some kind of hustle. We're going to do some overtime. We're going to sell a kidney. We're going to go to the blood bank. We're going to sell a car. We're going to downsize the house. We're going to ride share. We're going to do what we have to do to save the life of the person who we love. See, $1,000, for most of us sitting in this room, this is not an issue of ability. This is an issue of motivation. If we're going to get out of debt, we got to stop spending money we don't have. We're going to stop using these things. What am I going to buy stuff with? Cash. With money. And then we're going to save some money so that when we have a true emergency, something that we genuinely couldn't foresee coming, something we couldn't plan for, we can take care of that without borrowing more money. Number three, we're going to get out of debt. We have to attack debt. We have to start paying down some of this debt that we have. And here's the thing. Here's the thing about this. People who really get out of debt, there's an attitude that they bring to the table. There's a mentality that those people have that the people who don't get out of debt, they just don't have the mentality. Now, again, wisdom speaks to us this way about it. Wisdom says, my son, if you have become surety for your neighbor, if you have given a pledge for a stranger, if you have been snared in the words of your mouth, if you have been caught with the words of your mouth, which are all just a fancy way of saying, hey, kid, if you got yourself in a whole pile of debt, all right? Do this then, my son, to deliver yourself. Since you've come into the hand of your neighbor, go humble yourself and importune yourself to your neighbor. Give no sleep to your eyes. Give no slumber to your eyelids. Deliver yourself like a gazelle from the hand of the hunter and like a bird from the hand of the fowler. Now, again, if you're familiar with Dave Ramsey, he refers to this attitude as gazelle intensity. He makes a compelling argument. People who get out of debt, when they attack their debt, they attack it with gazelle intensity. Now, we've got a little gazelle here, all right? We've got the hunter coming, right? Now, just curious, how many of you growing up, you watched like National Geographic or Mutual Omaha Wild Kingdom, right? I didn't ever watch that. I'm not old enough for that. My parents told me about it. But who cheered for the predators, right? I used to love it when that lion or that cheetah caught that, whatever. In this case, we've got our gazelle, all right? He's fleeing from the hand of the hunter. Now, our gazelle is not thinking about getting away from the hunter. He's not going to give it some time or some effort if he has some. He's not going to divert a little bit of energy that way if it's convenient. Now look at this little guy. Look at his little eyeballs bulging, right? Look at just every little muscle is tense. He is all in, focused like his life depends on it, intense on getting away from that hunter. If we're going to get out of debt, this is the attitude. We have to be all in, focused like our lives depend on it, gazelle intense as we attack it. Do you know what you call a gazelle who is not gazelle intense? Lunch, right? There it is. That's what happens. You know what you call people who don't bring gazelle intensity in attacking their debts? You call them indebted and broke. This is just how this works. If we want out, you got to bring intensity to the table. Now again, best practice here tells us When you're attacking the debts, you start with the smallest one. You start with the smallest debt, you make minimum payments on the others, and you get after that first one. To which some people will say, well, that's not mathematically sound. You attack the debt with the biggest interest rate. We got to be financially prudent and sophisticated about this. To which I would say, look, if mathematics and financial sophistication, if this is what really, really mattered, we wouldn't be having this conversation about debt. All right? At this stage of the game, it's about motivation and momentum and intensity. So best practice is you take the smallest debt. You make minimum payments on the other ones. You make the payment on the smallest debt, and you throw all the margin in your budget at that smallest debt. And then when the smallest one is taken care of, you move on to the second smallest one. And you continue to make minimum payments on these. You throw all the margin in your budget at that second debt, plus what you would have thrown at the second one, plus what you were throwing at the first one at that second one. And then when the second one is paid off, you move to the third one. And you take what you were paying on the first and the second and the third and all the margin, you throw it at the third. And with each debt, the snowball gets bigger. And with each debt, the momentum begins to pick up. With each debt, as the momentum begins to spin, the motivation increases and the intensity increases. You can see a light at the end of the tunnel as you start knocking things off. So, debt. It's destructive and it's enslaving. And to get out, it starts with, I'm going to stop borrowing money. I'm actually going to save some, and then I'm going to start attacking these things. However, there's a couple more pieces we need to add to that. If we're going to get out of debt and stay out of debt, two other things we need to do. We need to learn how to make the money behave, and we need to learn how to master contentment. Now, we don't have time to talk about these last two today, but that, my friends, is what we're going to talk about over the course of the next 2 weeks. So I hope you join us for it.